Welcome to The Bitter Witness.
Don't be scared.
Hello. Welcome back. This is the second part of our two-part series on Anna Marie Hahn, the first woman ever executed by electric chair in Cincinnati, Ohio. When we left off, the police had just knocked at Anna's door, or as I have affectionately come to call her, Anna the Twat. So let's pick up where we left off. On Tuesday, August 10th, 1937, Anna Felser Hahn was arrested. Chief of Detectives Patrick Hayes stuck his head into the press room and told the reporters he had a hot story for them. He proceeded to tell the reporters everything he knew about Anna up to that point. From then on, Anna was known as the Blonde Borgia in the press, and the story was considered one of the most amazing cases in police history. Cincinnati police received a call from Colorado Springs detective Irvin Bruce asking that they detain Anna Hahn under suspicion of grand larceny. Rosie Turner, remember Rosie, the owner of the one hotel, had realized that her rings were missing and that it was Anna who had taken them. She reported the theft to the police and claimed that her rings were worth $305. Do you remember Anna only got $7 from a pawn shop for them? Bruce also wanted to question Anna regarding Johann Obendorfer. The Colorado Springs police was having a hard time finding out any information about Johann. He wasn't from Chicago, as Anna had told the hospital, but the police had found a clothier's tag inside Johann's clothing, and they called the shop in Cincinnati. The owner of that shop remembered the clothing and told the police that it was made for Johann Obendorfer, a resident of Cincinnati. Once Anna arrived at the police station, policemen crowded around their chief's desk, hoping to catch some of the conversation that was about to take place between a large Irish cop named Hayes and the beautiful German woman. Hayes asked her if she'd ever been to Colorado Springs and who she went with. Anna answered, "No one, only my son." He showed her a picture of a dead Johann, asking her if she knew him. She stated, yes, she knew him, but she didn't go out west with him. But then, amazingly, Anna remembered that she had in fact run into Johann on the train in Denver and discovered that he too was going to Colorado Springs. So she sat with him because she felt bad for him because he was old and lonely. Then Anna told Hayes that once the three had reached Colorado Springs, Johann's relatives never showed up to meet him. So she checked the three of them into a hotel. She did this because Johann was sick and she was kind-hearted. When Hayes asked Anna if she gave Johann anything to make him sick, Anna spit venomously back, "Do I look like a woman who would do a thing like that?" My answer would be yes. Just saying. As the questioning continued, another detective, Lieutenant George Shaddle, walked by and noticed the commotion that was happening surrounding the pretty blonde and Hayes. He asked who the dame was and informed that it was Anna Hahn. The name sounded instantly familiar to Shaddle, and then he realized he had found out that Jacob Wagner had befriended Anna Hahn before his death. Jacob's death was being investigated by two of Shaddle's detectives, Rathman and Kammer. During their investigation into Jacob's death, Rathman and Kammer had found out that the day after Jacob's burial, June 6th, Anna and Oscar and Anna's new boyfriend, only known to them as Ray, had taken a vacation to the Dix Dam area of Kentucky. Shaddle sent a detective out to Kentucky to investigate the vacation, and he found that at the cabin that Anna and her new boyfriend had rented, A car salesman by the name of James Theodore Woolridge had died mysteriously, and his body was found after Anna and Oscar had returned to Cincinnati alone. The body was found in a lake with a chain around his neck and tied to a box containing about 30 pounds of rocks inside it. However, the local coroner in Kentucky had identified the death as a suicide, and the police had dropped the case. But this death will come back to haunt Anna during her trial. Shaddle was able to insert himself into the interrogation and was asking Anna questions about Jacob Wagner. Anna proclaimed, "My conscience is clear. I never did anything wrong." When they were booking Anna into jail, they confiscated her white crocheted purse. Inside, they found a note that Anna stated to the police was from Jacob Wagner, that Jacob Wagner had actually written this note for her. It read, "Feel sorry for Mrs. Hahn. She is not to blame." Later, the police discovered that Jacob could only write in German, not in English. And did she really think that was going to work? So you get arrested for murder, multiple murder, and you just write yourself a little note and then say it's from one of the victims? Hayes interrogated Anna for 3 hours and then locked her up in a cell. Hayes and another officer, Grouse, then went to Anna's home to take a look around. They had already arranged for Oscar to stay with Philip's parents while Anna was incarcerated. Later that day, the Cincinnati chief of police telegraphed the Colorado Springs chief, Bruce, and told him that Anna did know Johann and that they had her in custody and that Chief Bruce needed to find evidence of the poisons. Bruce immediately contacted the coroner and told him to examine Johann's organs and see if they could find any trace of anything. Poor Johann was still in the morgue because no one had claimed his body. Wednesday, August 11th. So by now, the story was splattered all over the papers. And you remember Anna's ex, George Heiss, the man who owned the coal company? Well, he called the police and told them about his relationship with Anna. The police sent a car to collect George and bring him to the station. From here on out, George will be known as the living victim in the press. George was very gaunt and frail from the poison that Anna had fed him, but he was strong enough to sign the arrest warrant in the back of the police car for Anna, stating that she stole $140 cash and a $75 diamond ring from him, not to mention the $1,200 that she stole from the coal company. Then police sent officers to Philip's parents' house to pick up Oscar and bring him in for questioning. Hayes had already questioned Philip at home that morning. During the questioning, Philip stated that he knew nothing of his wife's trip to Colorado Springs until he had come home and found the note on the kitchen table telling him that that was where she and Oscar had gone. Philip also told Hayes that prior to Anna and Oscar's trip, he and Anna had had a big fight. You see, the big fight was because Oscar had found a bottle of poison in the house. And Philip was outraged that Anna would be so careless. And wait, why did she have a bottle of poison in the house? Philip had hidden the bottle in his locker at work. So he handed that bottle of poison over to Hayes. During Oscar's questioning, Hayes was able to catch the little boy in many lies. For example, Oscar told Hayes that he didn't know where the rings had come from that his mother had pawned. Hayes told the boy, "We already know that your mother took you to a pawn shop." To which Oscar answered, "Yes, but she didn't steal the rings. I found them as we were walking along the street." This poor child. That afternoon, Hayes, along with Detectives Hart and Burke, took Anna to her home. During the ride, Hart asked Anna if she had killed these men by screwing them. Anna quickly flashed a fiery stare at Hart and stated, "Don't talk to me like that, Schwein." Which means pig in German. When they arrived at Anna's house, she gave the three detectives permission to search it. Hayes headed for the cellar door, which made Anna immediately extremely upset. She yelled at Hayes, "What do you want down there? There's nothing down there." Which, of course, made Hayes want to go to the cellar even more. While Hayes searched the basement, Anna stood at the top of the stairs, watching and shifting nervously from one foot to the other. Hayes found an empty 4-ounce bottle hidden up in the rafters. There was white powdery residue still in the bottle. When Hayes came back upstairs and showed Anna the bottle, she said, "What do you want with that? It's probably an old bottle my son brought in." Anna reached for the bottle. "Give it to me," she said. Hayes pulled the bottle out of Anna's grasp, which only increased Anna's rage even more. Hayes handed the bottle to Burke and told him to keep it as evidence. When they all arrived back at the station, Hayes, Burke, and Hart continued to question Anna about her involvement in the deaths, but she maintained her innocence. She is quoted as saying to Hayes, "I love old people. I would not be the cause of any harm to them. It is strange that when I am trying to help them, these things should happen. It's what I get for being helpful." Unquote. Detectives were then sent to the Denver bank and retrieved the letter that Anna had forged trying to get $1,000 from Johann's account. They also managed to find the pawn shop and retrieved Rosie Turner's 2 diamond rings. Also on Wednesday, Colorado Springs police issued a warrant for Anna's arrest for larceny and murder. Now, she most likely would never have been sent to Colorado Springs to face these charges, but having these warrants in place meant that if something were to happen in Cincinnati that would allow Anna's release, she would be immediately arrested for the Colorado Springs warrants and extradited there. Philip called his lawyers, Bolsinger and Hooten, that day as he figured both he and Anna were in a world of trouble. His lawyers had represented him for years, but neither of the two lawyers in the firm had ever handled a serious matter like this. Thursday, August 12th. George Selman's name came up in the investigation. His body had been sitting in the morgue since July 6th, waiting for a family member to claim it. As the county was finally burying George Selman, coincidentally, about 100 feet from Jacob Wagner's grave, Selman's attorney entered the police station and informed the police that George had also known Anna. Immediately, the police called the cemetery and stopped the burial so that George could undergo an autopsy. The police then went to the German neighborhood and found August Schultz, a longtime friend of George Selman's, and brought him down to the station to possibly identify the woman he saw helping an ailing George to the bathroom. As soon as August walked into the station, he saw Anna and pointed at her and screamed, quote, "You are the woman. I know you by your looks and your voice," unquote. To which Anna screamed back across the station, quote, "I am not. You lie. I never knew the man," unquote. Can you just envision this in your head? She's sitting at Hayes's desk in the middle of the station. This German man walks in and starts screaming across the station. And Anna, not knowing who the man is that walked through the door, because I don't know if she knew August, but this man just randomly walks through the door and starts screaming at her, to which she turns around and says, "I didn't even know the man." So maybe we're implicating ourselves in something here. Anna needs to shut her mouth. I don't know why her lawyers didn't tell her to shut up. Friday, August 13th. Because this story has become so big and gone into so many different places around the U.S., it's starting to become a national story. And back in the 30s, when a prisoner was held in a cell, the cell was literally in the wolf's den of the police station, if you will, and reporters were just allowed to sit outside the cell and chat with the prisoners. So because of how big the story has gotten, Anna is now a celebrity. And reporters are clamoring to get to her, and they're just camped out in front of her cell asking her questions. So on Friday, August 13th, Anna declared to a reporter, 13 is my lucky number. That day, Anna gave her first interview to a reporter, Alfred Siegel of the Post. During the interview, Siegel asked Anna if these old gentlemen were interested in her. Anna replied with a laugh, quote, "They tell me Mr. Obendorfer is supposed to have said that I was a new woman of his. That is to laugh. I should be interested in a man like him. He was such a stupid old man." Unquote. Fuck you, Anna. She's such a horrible woman. She was also quoted by Siegel as saying that it was her duty to see that Jacob Wagner, Ernest Kohler, and Charles Oswald all got decent burials because it was the least you could do for people. Wasn't it? The rest of the day, with her attorney by her side, Anna fielded questions from both reporters and police alike. Anna maintained her innocence through the barrage of questions. At one point, someone asked her, "Mrs. Hahn, you want us to believe everything you say, but you won't explain the presence of that bottle in your home." Anna replied, quote, "That bottle? That's for you to find out. You found the bottle, now you find out about it." Unquote. What? 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 Anna the twat. Late in the afternoon, Hayes took Anna back to the interrogation room for another round of questions. Hayes was determined to find out where that bottle came from. This is unreal. After buttering Anna up with an old Irish lullaby that his mother used to sing to him, Anna admitted, with tears in her eyes, that she had bought the bottle from the druggist, Mr. Deming, the previous summer. Why did we not record Hayes's lullaby and play it to every criminal everywhere, ever? The autopsy results for Selman came back and determined that there was no croton oil in his system. As well, Anna and her attorney were sitting in the sheriff's office, waiting for the hearing to begin that would determine if Anna would be released from jail until her trial began. Anna sat and smiled beautifully for the reporters and stated, quote, "Come on, boys, take all the photographs you want. This is one case I'm going to win, I'll tell you that. I am not guilty, and I can face anything there is to come." Unquote. Anna lost the hearing that day and was returned to her cell. Saturday, August 14th. Anna was arraigned for the murder of George Selman and the larceny case. She would remain in custody. However, she was allowed a few minutes of privacy to visit with Oscar before being taken back to her cell. She hugged her son as they both wept, and she grabbed her son's face and said, "Son, don't you believe all those things about me?" As she stared deep into Oscar's eyes, the boy shook his head and told his mother he wouldn't. I feel so bad for this little boy. Sunday, August 15th, another reporter was granted permission to interview Anna, who, as with all the other opportunities she'd had so far, she professed her innocence to the reporter and to the world, who would no doubt be reading her story by now. On Monday, August 16th, Anna's case was taken to the grand jury. The grand jury listened to prosecuting attorney Dudley Miller Outcult describe Anna as the biggest mass murderer in history. After all the evidence had been shown, the grand jury returned two indictments for the malicious and premeditated murders of Jacob Wagner and George Selman. Later that morning, Shadow came to Anna's cell and informed her that, thanks to an old neighbor and friend of hers, they had managed to connect her to the sudden illness of one Mrs. Kreskay, who was currently residing in Hungary. Remember Kreskay, the neighbor that Anna had told her she would find her a job, but instead just took her money? And with this connection, Anna's story now became world news. The same day, Johann Orendorfer was buried in a cemetery in Colorado Springs. His family had discussed bringing his body home to Cincinnati, but that never happened. So even as of today, Johann is buried alone in a city he never knew and knew no one. Tuesday, August 17th. Anna was informed that morning that Olive Kohler had passed away the night before. Anna had thought that Olive was already dead, but she wasn't. She was gravely ill, and she was committed to the insane asylum, but Olive had hung on until August. Olive's sister, Mary, upon hearing of her sister's death, made a beeline for the police station to tell them that Anna Hahn had poisoned her sister. Handwriting analysis came back from the FBI labs on Jacob Wagner's will, and it had been determined that that will was penned by Anna Hahn. Anna granted a female reporter an interview about her life story, minus the identity of Oscar's real father. But the interview came to a quick stop when the reporter told Anna that she wasn't really giving her anything new. Anna kicked the reporter out of the cell and claimed, "I will not allow any more interviews or pictures." Who does she think she is, Norma Desmond? That night, Anna sent a cable to her mother stating, "Don't worry about me. I am innocent. That is all that counts. Pray for me." Wednesday, August 18th. Anna's arraignment was held at 9 a.m. Anna was brought into the courtroom and sat with her attorneys at the defense table. When Philip and Oscar entered the room through a side door, Oscar ran to his mother and leapt into her arms. The packed courtroom erupted. Flash bulbs popped and people stood on their chairs to try and get a better look. The bailiff ordered the commotion to settle down, and then the judge entered. Anna's attorneys asked for a change of venue because the prosecutors seemed to be trying the case in the press, according to them. Of course, the prosecution denied those allegations. The judge, Judge Bell, told Anna's attorneys to file a motion and he would hear the arguments for and against a change of venue on Friday. The prosecution stated that they were ready to go ahead with their case against Anna. On Thursday, August 19th, two reporters from the Cincinnati Times, Charles Ludwig and Peter Koch, decided to visit Selman's apartment and see what they could find. This reminds me of the Hall Mills murders, where the reporters went and dug up the well, remember? Ludwig came across a streetcar pass dated July 5th, 1937, the day before Selman died. On the back was written, "Go home, I'll be there." On Friday, August 20th, after a long day inside a stuffy courtroom packed with people listening to both sides argue for and against why there should be a change of venue, Judge Bell ruled there would be no change of venue. Anna received word that reporters had found her family in Germany and that one of her brothers had stated that no one from the family would be traveling to the U.S. to support their sister, as they were, quote, uninterested, unquote. Anna stated to the reporter who gave her this information that she couldn't understand why her family would say such a thing. They had always been extremely close. On Saturday, August 29th, Judge Bell announced that the trial would begin October 11th. And now we get into some of the trial. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the trial because this would make this a seven-parter. It's so big. But I will get to the more important parts. So the trial. The trial was moved to the biggest courtroom possible in Hamilton County. Judge Bell ruled there would be no photographs taken while the court was in session and that there would be no telegraph services in the courtroom itself. So a wire office was established in a room somewhere else in the courthouse so that when something happened in court, the news could be sent over the wire to the out-of-town news agencies. Anna was held in a cell on the sixth floor of the courthouse. And she, of course, had become somewhat of a celebrity. There were other inmates in the cell with Anna, and two of them would curl her hair and do her makeup each day. And a third female inmate became her gopher, running for cigarettes or coffee or really whatever she desired. Numerous visitors would attend the courthouse just so they could walk past her cell to catch a glimpse of her. She had now earned the name in the press as the jail's prima donna. During the trial, a reporter was interviewing Anna when she was in her cell, getting her hair done, getting ready for court. Anna told the reporter, quote, "I have my faith and knowledge that I have told the truth. They will never get a confession out of me because I can't confess to something I never did." Unquote. On the first day of court, Philip and Oscar entered the room. Oscar ran to his mother and hugged and kissed her, And Philip leaned over and told Anna, "Regardless of our marriage difficulties in the last few years, I absolutely believe in your innocence and will stick by you." Anna sent a smile towards Philip in thanks and then turned and sat with her attorneys. I am stunned by the ability of Anna to beguile all these men. I mean, she was beautiful. I will give her that. She was a beautiful woman. I just don't understand it. Philip, after hearing all of this, these things and seeing how she raised Oscar, he's still there with her. I don't get it. Oscar and Philip sat behind Anna in the courtroom for the first part of the first morning, but then Judge Bell ruled that no one under the age of 17 was allowed in the courtroom because, according to him, a murder trial was no place for a child. Yes, finally, thank you. Someone try and help this child a little bit. So at the morning recess, Philip left with Oscar. Thank God, the boy does not need to hear all of these things in this courtroom. Jury selection began, and this blew my mind for the 30s. The jury consisted of 11 women and one man. The press dubbed it the petticoat panel, and many reporters stated that they had never seen so many women on a jury before in their life. I could argue for both sides here. For the prosecution, I could see them wanting to have a jury made up mostly of women, because women are bitches, especially to each other, and women tend to judge each other harshly. Perhaps by having 11 women, they would be swayed towards judging Anna for what she had done. But on the flip side, the defense might want more women because even though women are bitches to each other, they were probably gambling on the fact that if Anna continued professing her innocence, trying to create this image of being a wholesome, caring woman who loved the elderly and was just trying to help, that women were more likely to gain sympathy for her. So, I mean, either way, but that's quite the composition of a jury, I'll say. From the start, the prosecutors insisted that Anna had killed Jacob Wagner out of greed, pointing out that his money and the estate were her motive for the murder. A barrage of witnesses were then called forth, starting with hospital employees who recounted Wagner's last agonizing days. According to the Cincinnati Inquirer, a chemist testified that the victim had enough arsenic in him to kill 4 men. A handwriting expert was then called forward and told the court that Wagner's will was a forgery and that the handwriting was identical to Anna Hahn. Handwriting analysis. Nevertheless, back then they believed in that. They thought that it was solid. In an unusual move, Judge Bell allowed the state to introduce evidence relating to the other poisoning cases in order to show a pattern of homicidal behavior. So she hadn't been convicted on those other crimes. And even if she had, they shouldn't have been allowed into the trial because it had nothing to do with Jacob Wagner or George Selman's murders. So now the prosecution has entered all of this other evidence saying, well, she poisoned this person, this person, this person, this person, which is going to really taint the jury. George Heiss, who we think is the only surviving victim, was also called forth to discuss his encounters with Hahn and his subsequent illness. And as the state's case wound down, they presented the court with several exhibits, which, oddly enough, included Jacob Wagner and Albert Palmer's internal organs. I don't know what they would have shown by that. Maybe if they had brought in some healthy internal organs to show the deterioration, but from what I could find, they only brought in the poisoned internal organs. But that would have been cool to see. The prosecution rested its case on October 29th, 1937. On Monday, November 1st, 1937, the defense began its presentation. With little evidence of their own to refute the state's claims, the defense was left only with the defendant. Once on the stand, Anna denied any wrongdoing, and during cross-examination, she couldn't be slipped up. This, however, amounted to little in comparison to the state's mountain of evidence and witnesses. that's the only thing they had was Anna sitting there saying, "I am innocent." With little else to do, the defense decided to hold their cards for closing arguments and rested their case on November 4th, 1937. Prosecutor Dudley Outcult was chosen to make the closing arguments for the state, and he wasted little time in getting to the point. She is sly because she developed her relationships with old men who had no relatives and lived alone. She was avaricious because no act was so low but that she was ready to commit it for slight gain. She is cold-blooded like no other woman in the world because no one could sit here for 4 weeks and hear this damaging parade of evidence and display no emotion. She is heartless because nobody with a heart could deal out the death she dealt these old men. We've seen here the coldest, most heartless, cruel person that has ever come within the scope of our lives. In the four corners of this courtroom stand four dead men: Selman, Palmer, Wagner, Obendorfer. From the four corners, bony fingers point at her and say, "That woman poisoned me. That woman made my last moments agony. That woman tortured me with the tortures of the damned." Then, turning to you, they say, "Let my death be not entirely in vain. My life cannot be brought back, but through my death and the punishment to be inflicted upon her, you can prevent such a death from coming to another man." From the four corners of this room, those old men say to you, "Do your duty. I ask of you, for the state of Ohio, that you withhold any recommendations of mercy." I love that closing argument. You can envision those four men standing in the corner of the room and pointing their bony skeleton fingers at Anna. Such drama. I love it. It was wonderful. And just a note, by asking for the jury to withhold any recommendations of mercy, that's an automatic death sentence for her. Following the prosecution's closing arguments, defense attorney Joseph Houdin stood up for the defense and addressed the jury. "I will not say that a single witness lied, but this case has had such widespread publicity that it would have been impossible for these witnesses not to have preconceived ideas before they ever came into this courtroom. Particularly, this is true of the witnesses from Wagner's neighborhood, where the case has been the chief topic of conversation for months. Although she is no angel, she is not guilty of the murder of Jacob Wagner." And with that, Houdin sat down. She really needed to find an attorney with experience who had defended someone for murder before, because that closing argument sucked. He literally just stood up and said, "Everybody is tainted by the news. Everything you saw inside this courtroom was tainted by the news, and she's not guilty," and sat down. Now we get to the decision. The jury had been sequestered for 23 days, and after two votes, the jury reached the unanimous verdict of guilty without the recommendation for mercy. While the jury may not have immediately realized it at the time, their decision was historic. The lack of recommendation for mercy meant that Anna Hahn would automatically be sentenced to death, and the state of Ohio had never executed a woman before. As the verdict was read, Anna quickly glanced at the jury, then bowed her head, trying to will back tears. She twisted her handkerchief around her hand, tighter and tighter. She was handcuffed and led back to her jail cell, while the reporters pushed around her and her lawyer, trying to get some kind of quote. But Anna had nothing to say to them, which was quite contrary to the outspoken and flirtatious Anna, who always had something to say to the reporters during the trial. She slammed the door of her cell closed behind her and threw herself on her bunk sobbing. One of her cellmates, Mabel Hill, yelled at the reporters to get lost as she hung a house dress up over the door to block Anna from the view of the reporters. Anna lifted her head and sobbed, "I can't understand it. I can't understand it. I never did it." On November 10th, 1937, Anna was again brought before Judge Bell. However, this time there was no question of her guilt, and the sole purpose of the hearing was to announce her ultimate fate. Judge Bell asked Anna if she had anything she wanted to say. "I have," she replied. "I'm innocent, Your Honor." Judge Bell paused momentarily and then formally sentenced her. "It is ordered, adjudged, and desired by the court that the defendant, Anna Marie Hahn, be taken hence to jail in Hamilton County, Ohio, and that within 30 days hereof, the sheriff of Hamilton County shall convey the said defendant to the Ohio Penitentiary and deliver her to the warden thereof, and that on the 10th day of March, 1938, the said warden shall cause a current of electricity sufficient to cause death to pass through the body of the said defendant. The application of such current to be continued until the said defendant is dead." Looking directly into Anna's eyes, he concluded, "And may God, in his infinite wisdom, have mercy on your soul." For the next month, Anna's sentence of death made its way through the courts of Ohio and the United States, but not one court decided to reverse the decision of death. On Tuesday, December 6, 1938, Ohio Governor Martin L. Davey made a formal statement in which he refused to interfere with the decision of the courts. Later that day, accounts on local radio by special dispatch from the Cincinnati Inquirer reported that Anna's execution was scheduled for 8 o'clock the next evening. The following day, Anna spent much of her time writing 4 separate letters, which she handed to her attorneys. As time moved closer and closer to Anna's execution, she became hysterical in her cell. Anna clung to Brandt, one of her attorneys, begging him for help, but there was nothing he or anyone else could do for the condemned woman. He put his arm around her as she wept and hysterically cried out for help. The prison chaplain, Father Sullivan, knelt beside Anna as she clung to Brandt and recited the Holy Viaticum. Anna cried out, "Oh, Heavenly Father, I can't go. I won't go until I see Mr. Houdin," another of her attorneys. Prison Colonel Walker, who was assigned to watch over the prisoner and escort her to the death chamber, leaned down to Anna and softly told her, "Mr. Houdin won't be here. He can't come now." At 8 p.m. exactly, Colonel Walker stood and stated, "It's time." Anna screamed, "No, I am not going." To which Walker replied, "Oh yes, Anna, you are going." 2 prison matrons helped the hysterical Anna to her feet. 33 witnesses were waiting inside the death chamber. Walker led the procession out of Anna's cell, followed by Father Sullivan, then Anna, who was still being held up and basically carried by the 2 female prison matrons. Behind Anna was her attorney Brandt, then 2 reporters, followed by 3 prison guards. The procession slowly made its way past the 11 men who were currently sitting on death row. As they passed the other condemned inmates, one said, "Good luck." Another said, "God bless you." Anna kept her eyes on the hallway, not wavering to look at the other condemned men, and said softly, "Goodbye, boys." Finally, the procession arrived at what was known as the goodbye door, the entrance to the death chamber. The giant door swung open, blasting the bright white lights into Anna's face. When the glare cleared from her eyes, she saw Old Sparky, as the electric chair was nicknamed by the guards in the prison and those in the press. Anna collapsed to a heap, screaming, "Oh no! No! Oh no!" The prison doctor snapped open a vial of smelling salts and waved it under Anna's nose. 2 guards, the prison matrons, and the prison doctor rushed to pick up Anna and carried her to Old Sparky. Her legs were thrashing, and she was hysterically screaming, "No, no, no! Don't do this to me!" The male death row prisoners could hear Anna's screams as plain as day, even after the door to the death chamber was closed, which only speaks to the volume of Anna's screams, as the death chamber was supposed to be soundproof. Anna's screams sent chills through all 33 witnesses present inside the death chamber, as well as the prison guards stationed throughout the room. Guards quickly and with expertise shackled Anna into the chair as she screamed, "Oh, don't! Please don't! Think of my boy!" The guards cinched the waist strap around Anna's waist. The sudden tug slammed her back against the back of the chair. "Don't do this to me," she continued to cry out. Oh, no, no, no. Warden Woodard, don't let them do this to me. Tears began to roll down the warden's face as he solemnly replied, I am sorry, but we can't help it. Upon hearing the warden's words, Anna began to scream, Please don't. Oh, my boy, think of my boy. Won't anyone come and do something for me? Isn't there anybody to help me? Anyone? Anyone? Is nobody going to help me? A guard pulled Anna's hair that was on top of her head to the side and placed a copper disc on the area that had earlier been shaved clean. Her hair had been pulled over to cover the area to try and keep some dignity for Anna in her last moments. The chin strap was placed around her head and tightened to keep the disc in place. Anna screamed in terror and began to writhe as best she could, strapped to the chair. There was a bucket of water that sat just to the side of the chair in case her hair caught on fire from the electricity. Anna wailed and let out one last plea. No one is going to help me? A guard clamped an electrode to her right calf. As prison officials let the clock click down in the off chance that the governor might call, Anna called out for Father Sullivan. Father, come close, she said. Father Sullivan, now with a steady stream of tears down his face, knelt beside Anna and placed his hand on hers. Anna screamed, Don't touch me! You might be killed! A guard slipped the black mask over Anna's head. There was only an opening at the nose for her last breaths. Father Sullivan began to recite the Lord's Prayer. Anna, along with the two prison matrons and several others inside the death chamber, repeated each line after Father Sullivan. There were tears streaming down all their faces now. They only reached, Lead us not into temptation, when the light behind the chair flashed from green to red. Anna's body jerked and raised up out of the chair as much as it could with the straps holding it down. There was no sound from Anna. Her thumb jolted upward. There was a whirring sound as the chair sent 1950 volts for 10 seconds through Anna's body. Then a lower whir sounded as the chair dropped to 500 volts for 40 seconds. And then the original whir returned as the chair went back up to 1950 volts for another 10 seconds. A puff of smoke rose up from Anna's body as the prison doctor placed a stethoscope on her chest, listening for a heartbeat. He whispered to the warden, Her heart is still beating. The doctor stared at the warden for a good 20 seconds. When the warden tipped his head towards Anna's body again, the doctor nodded and placed his stethoscope on Anna's chest again. This time, there was no heartbeat. The doctor turned to face the witnesses and stated that enough electricity had run through Anna's body to cause death at 8:13 p.m. And with that statement, prisoner number 73228, Anna Marie Hahn, was officially pronounced dead at 8:13 p.m. She was the 214th prisoner executed in Ohio and the first woman to die by electric chair. She is buried close to downtown Columbus, and a very weathered headstone made by the prisoners at the penitentiary marks her grave to this day, but her name is no longer visible. And that is the case of Anna Marie Hahn, the first woman executed in the state of Ohio. My thoughts? I believe Anna deserved to have the death penalty. She was a cold, calculating, callous murderer. She was a serial killer, no different than Ted Bundy or Jeffrey Dahmer. The only difference is she stretched her killings out much, much longer than either of those two killers. But she is no different. She took human life for profit, which maybe in some eyes might make her worse. The trauma and the victimization that she instilled on her own son was deplorable. Taking her son with her as she was murdering people. I know I don't always agree with the death penalty, but in this case, I agree. She deserved to die. the torture that she put on those people. Even if they didn't die from the poison, some of them were permanently disabled from what she did to them. And just think of the descriptions of the men in their last few days or few hours or even few minutes of life. The writhing pain. This was a horrible case. And some of the terror that Anna felt inside the death chamber once she got past the goodbye door, I think is just a little bit of justice for her. I realized there were a lot of tears inside that death chamber, but no one ever asked anyone if those tears were for Anna or for her victims. Well, that was a long case, but we made it through. Thank you for joining me. If you enjoy the show, please head over to Patreon and support us. For a few cents a day, you can have access to the exclusive content, The Bitter Bits. And I will see you on the next episode. Enjoy your day today. This has been a Bitter Witness production.